down and against her neck as her head stretched upward and the long mane covered my face. I scrambled to get my fingers into her hair, wrapped an arm around her neck, and dug my legs against her sides. The pressure of her rising body forced the air from my lungs, and it was all I could do to hold on as the backing of the metal star pinned to my jacket drove itself into my chest. Her hair still covered my face, but parted at the rim of the canyon just enough for me to see that the old man was now astride the broad back of his own cloud pony, his one hand wrapped in the mane of his horse, the other reaching into the billowing expansion above us. I looked up at the detonation of clouds that seemed like a saturated watercolor. Compacted flares fired deep in the towers of umber, white, and disappearing blue, and reflected in the flanks of my paint. Her rhythm was steady and sure, and her eyes watched carefully as if a misplaced hoof would send us plummeting into the distant earth below. The medicine man's lips moved, and even though his voice was barely a whisper, the sound of his words echoed within the clouds like drums. "This is better, yes?" I stared at him, and it was clear to me he was insane. He laughed. "How can you know the earth if you never see it?" I looked past his outstretched arm at the glow of the clouds, and at one that looked like an eye with a circle around it. "Mr. Longmire, Sheriff?" I opened my eyes, moved the towel, and looked at the hand on my shoulder. It was a man's hand of pretty good size, and had a graduation ring on it from the Philadelphia Police Academy. "How you doing?" "Howdy, Michael." He smiled and watched me some more. "You were snoring." "Sorry." I looked up at the windows, but they were still black. "What time is it?" "Little after 4. I told Mom I'd take an extra shift, seeing as how I've got time on my hands." I took a deep breath and looked at the handsome young man with so much of his life ahead of him. "Michael, have you ever heard of a guy by the name of Shankar Duval?" He thought about it. "Doesn't ring any bells." He shrugged. "I can ask around." I nodded. "He might be one of the guys we arrested out on Lancaster Avenue. I'll check." He looked at Katie, at the arrangement of the ceremonial pipe, the buffalo skull, and the stones. "Looks like you guys have been busy." I stood, stretched my arms above my head, and approached the bed with hope, ready to curdle at the slightest notice. I decided to refer to a higher authority. There was no change, and I could feel my heart cannonballing into my bowels, taking my lungs along for the ride. I took a deep breath and listened to it clatter in my throat like a rattler in shedding season when it's blind, pissed, and strikes out at everything. I heard Michael say something. "I'm sorry, what?" "You should go home." I turned and looked at him. "You're right." I then thought about whether I would be giving up Moretti family secrets, finally deciding that I wouldn't. "Your sister's in town." He looked blank. "Victoria?" His smile returned. He couldn't hold the joke. "I know. I'm the one that called her. I called her day before yesterday." He studied me for a moment. "I didn't think you'd mind, and I thought she'd be a help." I didn't say anything. He continued to smile and shuffled his purple and orange-clad feet, still not sure of my response. "She's a good cop." I finally nodded. "I'm in a position to know that." The kid was a prince. I started off with a taxi, but my restlessness drove me to abandon it at 20th and Market. I kind of knew where I was and figured if I headed north by northeast, I'd eventually hit Race and take a right. If I got to the river, I'd have gone too far. I watched as a black expedition stopped at the light and then started up the street. I saw a sign for the Franklin Institute about a block up and decided to continue north for a while. It must have rained while I was asleep, sometime during my vision, as Henry would have called it. The streets were wet, but it was still the cool of the morning before sunrise, and the halos of the streetlights looked like chain links drifting up the dark city streets. I listened to my boot steps echoing off the tall buildings, and gathered wool on the directions our lives take, on the intersections that allowed no U-turn and committed you to your fate. I thought about how I wished there was somewhere I could go and just pay the fine and take my daughter home. At the corner of Arch, I stopped and looked around. My eye caught some movement behind me, and I turned my head just a little. It was the same black expedition that I had seen on Market. It sat there at the red light, the reflection of the street lamps making it impossible to see inside. I put my hands in my pockets and acted as though I was deep in thought. It passed me, and I watched the taillights of the vehicle slow and then recede, listening to the radial tires growl as they turned down the deserted street. I took my hands out of my pockets and laughed out loud. What was I thinking? That I was important enough to be followed around the streets of Philadelphia? I shook my head and continued on. The sun wouldn't be up for a while, so maybe I could grab a couple more hours of sleep before calling Katz and Gowder for a meet. It would be interesting to hear their take on the Vince Osgood parade of stars, but even more interesting to see their response to Vic. I wondered what Lena's response to Vic would be, and wondered if Alphonse had gotten anywhere with Lena's hunch about a different connection between Osgood and Devon. I was in the middle of all this wondering when I saw the black expedition again, crossing the street a block ahead. There was a narrow alley to my right, and I ducked in there. I wedged myself in a doorway between a power pole and a utility box alongside the back of a building. I stood there, feeling foolish for a few minutes, until I saw the black SUV slowly go up 20th. It looked like a government vehicle, but who would be trailing me in something like that? Osgood? Katzengowder? It just didn't make sense, unless they'd come to the conclusion that the notes had made me a viable candidate for being thrown off a bridge next. I went to the corner and watched as the expedition turned right a block ahead and once again circled around. Whoever they weren't very good at this, which led me to believe they weren't on the job. I looked back up the alley and started jogging toward 19th. By the time I got to the other end, the expedition was moving slowly down the street in its attempt to double back. A large Amoroso bread truck pulled up to the light just south, and I pressed myself against the corner of another building. The SUV passed me and stopped behind the truck. If I was feeling frisky, now was the time. Approaching unsecured vehicles was how the majority of police officers got killed. But I thundered down the sidewalk, slid to a stop alongside the Ford, and yanked the door open anyway. Before I could say anything, the driver yelled, "Yo, man! You tailing me?" I looked at the tall, lean kid at the wheel. He didn't look like a cop or a robber. He wore glasses and had long brown hair pulled back in a ponytail and a 3-day beard. He looked like a graduate student, and he looked at me like I was crazy. "What?" I was having the same doubts myself. I held up my hands to show there was no intent. "Sorry, I thought you were following me." He studied me. "You a cop?" "Yep." I didn't have to say from where. He nodded and took a breath. I guess I'd almost given him a heart attack. "Sorry." He didn't move, but kept looking at me. "Jesus, man, you scared the shit out of me." He took a deep breath as the bread truck released its air brakes and started around the corner. "I thought you were some kind of carjacker or something." "No, you were driving slowly, and I thought you were following me." "I was looking for an address, man." I nodded, feeling the complete fool. "Sorry." He stuck a hand out and stopped me from closing the door. "Hey, man, do you know where the Municipal Services Building is?" I shook my head. "No." I started closing the door, but he kept talking. "I've got this package that has to be delivered by..." I closed the door as he held the FedEx envelope toward me, and it was at the last second that I noticed the ignition switch and the destroyed lock where the expedition had been hotwired. I clawed at the door, trying to get it back open as he hit the gas, and I slapped at the back of the vehicle's glossy surface. I watched as he made the mistake of turning left behind the bread truck that was now halfway down the street and backing into a loading zone with the reverse alarm chirping. I watched as the SUV screeched to a stop at the middle of the block. He hit the horn, but the Amoroso man was having none of it. He locked the air brakes on the big truck and turned on his emergency blinkers, whoever was behind him, be damned. God bless Philly truck drivers. I pushed off a parked car at the corner and ran for all I was worth, struggling to pull the .45 from the holster at my back. The driver of the Ford continued to blare his horn, but when I was only 30 feet from the SUV, license number 90375, city plates, the reverse lights flicked on. I slid to a stop in the center of the street in a widespread stance, raised the .45 and yelled, "Police, freeze!" He didn't, and I had to decide if a hunch was worth shooting a man, finally deciding that it wasn't. He was still in reverse, but he wasn't going that fast, and I figured, what's the worst that could happen? I jumped up on the back bumper and grabbed the luggage rack as the air left my body on impact. My left hand held the black bar, and I listened as the bracings buckled into the sheet metal of the roof. My feet slipped from the bumper as he accelerated, and I scrambled to get a tiny purchase, trying to not think about what the hell I was doing. I wasn't going to last long like this, so I raised the butt of the Colt and swung it down on one of the back windows, the glass spider-webbed out to the framework. I could feel the luggage rack starting to go as he hit the brakes at race and made a right onto Logan Circle. A Japanese compact barely missed us as we made the turn and cut across four lanes. I brought the butt of the .45 down on the window again, and this time the glass blew into the interior along with my arm, and I was able to leverage myself up to the armpit into the vehicle. I pressed my face against the cold metal of the window divider and could feel the glass cutting along my jawline. "Peace officer, stop this vehicle now!" I could see him sawing at the wheel and could feel the pressure of my grip starting to slide me toward the edge of the bumper as he continued to veer around Logan Circle and the Swan Memorial Fountain. He swerved back toward the outside, deciding to test the waters on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway, but a utility company van cut him off. I took advantage of the slowing velocity to reestablish my grip on the doorway just as the luggage rack pulled completely off the vehicle. My feet slid on the bumper as I slipped sideways, and I felt my boot hit the surface of the road and pogo with a large hop as I threw my other arm into the back window and scrambled for a grip. I was to the point of dropping the .45 when my other hand grabbed hold of some small leverage, and it was only when the door I was hanging from made a small jump with a chunk-like sound that I realized that it was the interior door handle. The door swung wide with the momentum of the vehicle, and I was no longer attached. I rolled my back, my head cracked against the concrete sidewalk, and my legs went over my shoulders. I tucked my arms into my chest along with the semi-automatic and hoped that wherever I was rolling, nobody would run over me. I didn't move at first. Just watched the black expedition continue the wrong way down 18th and disappear as I listened to sirens approach like hounds to the hunt. I tried to focus, but my vision was blurred. My head hurt, and I closed my eyes. I could hear people, so that was a good sign. I opened my eyes and looked up at a gigantic individual with a tri-cornered hat looking down on me. It was only when I saw it was a statue and that the title on the base had way too many consonants that I collapsed against the cement and tried to breathe. "Sir?" I felt somebody gently pull at my right shoulder in an attempt to turn me over. "Sir, are you alive?" I rolled onto my back and watched as whomever it was backed away when they saw the big Colt in my hand. "It's all right." I coughed and cleared my throat, my voice sounding like somebody else's. "I'm a peace officer." The face returned, and I looked at his uniform. "You a cop?" He shook his head. "I'm the bellman. I've been here since the hotel opened, and that was the most dramatic entrance to the Four Seasons I ever seen." I laughed weakly and felt a pull at my abdomen, curled in a little, and returned to my side where it felt better. He kept his hand on my shoulder and talked to me in a soft voice. "Don't you worry. There's help coming. You just lie there." I stared at the traffic and took shallow breaths, absorbing some of the cool from the sidewalk. I felt a little dizzy for a moment, but it passed with the adrenaline discharge, and I stared past the traffic at the fountain at the center of Logan Circle, with the swans blowing jets of water 30 feet into the air. And there it was, the Indian I was meant to go back to. Chapter 11.
"So you got the license plate number of the truck that hit you?"
She sat on the back of the chair with her feet on the seat, the kind of posture that made teachers yell. It was a cop convention at Hupp. They had tried to take me to Hahnemann, which was only 4 blocks from the Four Seasons, but I had told them I'd throw myself from the ambulance if they didn't take me to the same hospital as Katie. After careful consideration, and in light of recent events, they took me at my word. Like I told the Fuzz, city plates 90375. The stitches at my jawline pulled when I talked. Dr. Rissman was looking at my ear, but he didn't say anything, so he must have figured that was old news. I guessed he had come down to take a look at me out of curiosity, and that you could pretty much jump in any time if you were a neurosurgeon. Vic turned to look at the two detectives as Katz flipped his small notebook closed. Stolen from the city lot 2 nights ago. Gowder looked at Vic, she looked at Katz, and I could tell that they had all three known each other for quite some time. Michael was leaning against a wall, and they had posted a patrolman outside the curtain. Gowder stepped forward and held up a standard wants and warrants vita with a 2x2 photo of William Whiteyes. He was slightly heavier, wore no glasses, and the hair was loose. That's him. Katz walked over beside Vic and adjusted his glasses, the red dots jockeying for a good seat on his nose. He was a handsome devil, and I could see Lena making the reach. Released a week ago. After you mentioned him last night, we did a quick look-see. Any idea why he was following you? We cowboys have that problem with Indians, even white ones. Katz gave me a look. Any word on Shankar Duval? The two detectives turned and looked at Michael, who grinned. Looks like he was the one that you ran into the other night. Turns out Fraser and the others couldn't retrieve the gun and he wasn't carrying, so they had to let him go. What about his connections with Toy Diaz? We got a hit on an abandoned car in Atlantic City, but no Diaz. I think I may have met Toy Diaz last night. They all looked at me as Gowder continued to wait on the phone for the current address of one William Whiteyes. Katz cleared his throat. Where? At the shooting range. He was with Osgood. At least, I think it was him. Short guy, Latino, very precise, eyes like a snake. The detective nodded his head slowly. That sounds like him. Gowder flipped his cell phone closed. We've got an address. Vic sipped her coffee. Asa, why would William Whiteyes want to hurt Walt? If he's the one that knocked on the Franklin Institute door, sent Devon to flight school, and wrote the note, we should focus on Toy Diaz. Believe me, we are, but maybe the sheriff here was getting too close for comfort. He could have run over him twice. I shook my head and raised a single sprained finger. Excuse me, once. Katz glanced back at me. I think Whiteyes did a pretty good job on him. But he didn't kill him. She hadn't said anything about the note I'd given her, and I thought maybe I wouldn't say anything about it just yet. I reached for the fresh shirt that Vic had brought me from Katie's. She said that she had met her mother there and that Lena was taking care of Dog. Gowder was watching me. Where do you think you're going? With you. Oh, no, you're under house arrest until we get William Whiteyes. I looked at the two of them. So, the partnership is over? Gowder smiled as they left. Looks that way. I waited till they were past the curtain. What if I told you I got another note? Vic took a sip of her coffee and snorted. They stopped without turning, stood there for a moment, and then Gowder looked back at Vic, to Katz, and then to me. Bullshit. Vic? She took her time taking another sip. Off the bridge at the crime scene. She pulled the envelope from her pocket and held it up between her index and middle fingers. I went ahead with putting on my shirt. I also know where the next one is. Katz took the envelope, opened it, and read the card. I don't suppose it occurred to you two to have this dusted? Were there any fingerprints on the other one? Any DNA sample from the envelope? He didn't answer, and I had mine. Katz passed the note to Gowder and looked up at me. Where? Vic climbed off her chair and stretched. Does this mean the partnership's back on? She stepped over and helped me from the gurney. So, did my little brother start his crush before or after your daughter was in a coma? Bodine Street was in an industrial complex 5 blocks north of the Benjamin Franklin Bridge. I mentioned to Vic that it was convenient since she was the only one in the car speaking to me. John Myford, White Eye's parole officer, was going to meet us there, which was good because without the tan sedan parked at the corner, we might have never found the place. He was heavy-set with sandy hair and was waiting for us on the sidewalk. He made for the door next to a truck dock. I looked around, but I didn't see anything that would have led me to believe the address was a residence. Myford shrugged and pushed open a steel door that had a wire mesh grate over the glass. There was an unused beat-up counter in an entryway with a scratched plexiglass divider that led to a freight elevator. We all stepped over the opening between the floors, and Myford clanged the heavy metal sliding gate that closed from the top and bottom, dropped another safety grating from above, and hit the button to his left. The whine of the counterweight system and the condition of the cables inspired little confidence, but the battered elevator rose to the sixth, where Myford aligned the black spray-painted arrows on the gate with the ones on the adjacent bricks. He lifted the safety gate, and we walked out into a large, industrial loft that was surrounded by 18-foot glass-paned walls. The floors were hardwood, and there was nothing in the 5,000 square feet except a painted teepee. It was in the center of the space, and its 16 hand-peeled poles extended upward and into a ventilation cupola. Everyone, including Myford, looked surprised. "I take it this is new?" Nobody said anything but turned and walked toward the structure that would have looked much more at home. Well, back home. I watched as Gowder unsnapped the holster where his 40 Glock rested. It was a family-sized teepee with rows of ledger paintings traversing the heavy canvas. It sat there, a domestic island at the center of industrial isolation. As we got closer, I could see that the stake loops were tied off to Velcro straps that had been attached to the wooden floor and that there were buffalo rugs and blankets spilling from the opening even though the flap was secured and tied shut. There was a totem with a mule deer skull that was painted and wrapped in trade cloth and beads in the crow style. There were feathers and a fringe of leather draped from the upright pole which stood in a slot that had been cut in the floor. The place was clean, the floors swept, and the hundreds of window panes had been washed and reflected the structure in the middle of the room. Gowder was in the lead and turned to look back, the empty eye sockets of the antlered skull looking at me over his shoulder. He pointed at the head. "What in the hell is this?" "A teepee marker." They all looked at me blankly. "It's kind of a combination welcome sign and mailbox." Everyone else stopped, but I continued to the right, reading the story of the drawings that circled the teepee. The center line had caught my attention. They were horses with men on them, shooting at each other. Not something totally unique to the form, but the details were different than those I was used to seeing. The men on horseback were not red, but were white and black. They were not shooting arrows or sharps, but were firing modern weapons. One even wore a 76ers jersey. The uniforms of the white riders and their hats indicated that they were policemen. And the large man, falling comically from the back of a horse, wore a star in his chest. The center line had not been finished. There was a set of paints on the floor, a Dixie cup full of thinner and a couple of brushes, one of which had paint on it. I stooped and touched the brush, and the bright red pigment was still wet. I looked around and spotted an open window hinged at the top at the back of the loft. "Is that a fire escape?" They all looked at me as I held up a fingertip daubed red. "He was just here." Gowder was the first to move, quietly slipping the Glock from his holster and heading for the fire escape while gesturing for Katz to take the stairwell. Asa's sidearm appeared in his hand, and they fanned out. Myford turned and looked at me. "I don't carry." I caught Vic's attention as she came around the other side and tossed her the 45 from my pancake holster. I wished I were feeling better. I watched as she took the route I would have, the one toward the fire escape. She looked odd with my large-framed Colt in her small hands, but she held it with a confidence born of 5 years street duty, all in these very streets. I watched them, sighed, and continued with my bruised ribs and aluminum-shrouded finger around the teepee. There were more ledger drawings on the back side,
One with a man in a suit and tie pushing a red-haired woman from a cliff, and then another of the same man falling from what looked like a burial platform. The Devon Conliff story.
Vic returned with Gowder from the fire escape. He looked at the paints on the floor, kneeled, and tested the brush. Evidently, he didn't trust my analysis.
Careful, or you get it on your suit.
He nodded and wiped his fingers on a stained towel that lay on the floor.
Nothing on the roof.
I looked back at Myford.
If you don't mind my asking, how does a guy like William Whiteyes have a place like this?
His uncle owned the building and left it to him in a trust.
I straightened up and breathed for a minute.
I take it William comes from money?
Quite a bit, actually. The kid had it all. A dress in Gladwin, Ivy League, advanced degree in chemistry, even a shot at the Olympics in dressage.
Interesting.
I turned back to the front and looked at the closed flap.
I assume we are ignoring the fact that we might need a warrant.
Myford cocked his head.
It's a tent.
We stared at each other for a second, then I glanced over at Vic, tugged at the strips of canvas, and watched as the flaps opened. I looked into the relative darkness of the teepee.
I don't suppose anyone has a flashlight.
They all shook their heads, so I kneeled for a better view. The top flaps were closed, so only a little light made it to the floor. There was stuff in there, and the only way I was going to find out what it was to go in. So I did. Warrant be damned. I was able to keep the finger guard from bumping into anything as I slid into the teepee with my legs trailing behind me. It had occurred to me that William Whiteyes might be inside, but I couldn't hear any breathing, and made the assumption I was alone. All I could see were the folds of more buffalo skins and a few Navajo blankets piled in one corner. There was nothing more in there. Evidently, William Whiteyes was living somewhere else. This place must be a work in progress, or just for show, at least for now. I sat there in the muffled silence. I could barely hear the conversation among the three policemen outside. It felt like home. Then I closed my eyes for just a moment to block out the talk, the traffic from the streets below, and the thunder of jets overhead. I thought of the old medicine man that I had seen in my dreams, and heard the words that had lifted the two of us above the canyon on the wind that had cleansed and combed the high plains. How can you know the earth if you do not see her? Under the buffalo robes, where the earth would have been if the teepee had been in Wyoming, was a parflesh satchel painted with bright geometric shapes and decorated with horsehair and the tiny cone bells that the Cheyenne call Aksaksevo. I moved back toward the opening so I could see, untied the strips of leather that held the satchel closed, and pulled out two actual ledgers. I opened the top one, and it was a full accounting of some kind of business dealing and was written entirely in a language I recognized but could not read. I looked up to see Vic's outline in the opening. No sign of him. I nodded and took as big a breath as my ribs would allow. I've got something here. I closed the book and placed it carefully on top of the portfolio. But I'm not sure exactly what it is. Once I'd wriggled my way outside, I set the book on my lap and opened it to a random page. Everyone looked, and Vic kneeled in front of me, but Gowder was the first to speak.
What language is that?
It's Cheyenne. The teepee design.